Thank you so much. Okay. All right. A few years ago, I gave a talk at the Neeli Archei Kala about Moshe and Second Temple period and rabbinic literature. And one of the things that I showed is that Moshe is a Homeric figure in Second Temple Jewish literature. Moshe is infallible. He is a scientist. He is a philosopher. He is a military warrior. He embodies all of the qualities that a Homeric hero would embody. He's almost not human, right? In the same way that Homeric heroes are semi-divine in early Jewish pre-rabbinic literature, in Greek literature really, literature that is written from the 5th century BCE through the 1st century CE, Moshe is this infallible hero, right? But in the rabbinic period, Moshe becomes a humanized proto-rabbi. We have these very moving scenes in rabbinic midrash about Moshe standing in the back of the Beit Midrash and hearing the teachings of Rabbi Akiva, and he doesn't understand anything, right? We have midrashim about Moshe being scared of his death, fleeing from the angel of death, and all of the bodies of the earth, the mountains, the rivers, the oceans, they're all protecting Moshe from the angel of death, right? The angel of death goes all over looking for Moshe. Where's Moshe? I need to kill him, right? I need to bring him into paradise. And they all say, we haven't seen Moshe. We don't know where he is, right? Moshe becomes this mortal figure, this person who is even more mortal than you and I. In some scenes, he is arguing against God, yelling at God on behalf of Israel. And we talked about, if you were there, we talked about this transition. How do we go in a century or two centuries from Moshe being this Homeric, almost semi-divine figure to being a mortal proto-rabbinic figure who's fraught with ambivalence about his relationship with God, about his relationship with Israel? And today I bring you the sequel. Today we're going to talk about God. And what's very interesting is that there are two things that the Tanakh does not talk about, that we talk about a lot as Jews. One is the afterlife. Right? There's very little about heaven, about hell, right? About the ultimate rewards. Now we have some discussion of Sheol, right? The patriarchs say, when I go down to Sheol, Sheol is kind of like Hades. In other words, there's kind of a physical aspect to Sheol. It's not exactly like Olam Haba, right? The world to come. We have very little material in the Tanakh that we might call apocalyptic, right? Or what happens after we are gone. There's also very little description of God. Now, of course, God is extremely present, right, in the story of the Israelites, and God in some places anthropomorphized, meaning we have God stretching out his arm, right? We have God feeling the feelings, right? Very upset when the Jews build the golden calf. But we don't have descriptions of the essence of God. What is God, right? What are the qualities of God? Now, the closest we get is in Shmo Perek Lamed Bet to Lamed Dalid, when after the Chet HaEgel, God, Moshe says, I need to see you, right? And God says, nobody can see me and live. Lo yir ani adam v'chai. And then God says, all right, but fine. Just stand behind this rock and I'll pass before you. And then we have the 13 midot, right, of mercy. And there's a big question of what are these 13 qualities? We don't really have anything else like this in the Tanakh, descriptions of God. In the Second Temple period, Jews start to write down their conceptions of what God is. And unsurprisingly, once we enter into the Hellenistic period, so after 334 BCE, once the Jews are living in the Greco-Roman world, God becomes, parallel with what happens to Moshe, very Homeric. In other words, God is infallible, God is universal, right? God is totally distant from humanity, right? Because humanity is mortal and physical, corporeal, right? Totally limited in what our brains can do. So God is otherworldly. And similarly to what happens to Moshe, in the rabbinic period, God is deeply, intimately involved in humanity. How does this transition occur? So I'm going to do something very new for me today, which is try to speak slowly. Because usually I give an 8 to 10 page source sheet, and it's only 4 pages, so you're welcome. But the reason why it's 4 pages is because these are very hard sources. So we're going to take our time, and probably still at 11:30 I'll realize that I haven't done everything, but we're going to try to move a little slowly here because these sources are very, very tricky, some of them. I only have a little tasting menu here of a few Jewish Hellenistic sources that predate the rabbinic era, and a few rabbinic sources, a tasting menu that's representative of, I think, this transition that we see. And we begin with, I don't have a chalkboard here or smart board, but imagine, here's your mental timeline, okay? So the Babylonian exile is over here, obviously, right? And the Babylonian exile begins in 586 BCE, right? It ends in around 538 BC. The numbers go down because we're before the year zero, right? Who conquers the Babylonians?
Persians and the Medes.
Persia, right? Right? In 538, Cyrus has kind of wiped the Babylonians out. Not exactly. Nothing happens overnight, but now we're sort of in the Persian period. Now the Judeans are allowed to return back to the land of Israel, to Judea, right? And it's at that moment that we have this notion of a permanent diasporan Jewish presence, meaning most Jews do not go back to Judea, right? And over the next two or three centuries, Jews are spreading and spreading and establishing communities all over the world. By the time Alexander the Great conquers Persia in around 334, he dies in, maybe, I think, 323, by the time that happens, Jews are living all over the world, right? And so when we enter into the Hellenistic period, there are Jews all over the Mediterranean, right? And when Alexander founds the great city of Alexandria in Egypt, Jews settle there right away. So by the end of the Second Temple period, we had Jews in Alexandria, hundreds of thousands of them, tens of thousands at least, maybe probably hundreds of thousands of Jews in Italy, in Rome, tens of thousands of Jews in Antioch, in the great city north of the land of Israel. And so when we enter the Greek period, right, Greece comes after Persia, we have a diasporan community of Jews that is in the millions. What are these Jews writing on? Now, I say this at the beginning of every year, so just close your eyes and take a nap if you heard me say this over. I say this all the time. There really is no binary between Greek Jewish culture and Hebrew-speaking Jewish culture at this time, meaning you can't demarcate between the Hebrew-speaking Jews and later Aramaic-speaking Jews in the land of Israel and the Jews who are speaking Greek outside the land of Israel. You can't make a line of piety. See, we think this way because of Hanukkah, right? We think that all the Jews who are speaking Greek are Hellenized and assimilated, and all the Jews who are speaking Hebrew, Aramaic, and Judea are pious, observant Jews. That is not a binary that correlates with the evidence. Meaning, there are Greek-speaking Jews in Alexandria who are keeping Shabbat, dietary law, kashrut, and are writing and writing and writing and writing. And we have these texts. Amazingly enough, we have these texts. These are not preserved in a canon. They're not scriptural, but they're historical evidence, and we're going to look at some today. One of the most interesting documents that dates to the 2nd century BC is a document called the Letter of Aristeas. And this is the first source. The Letter of Aristeas is a text, it's not really a letter, that tells us about how the Hebrew Bible came to be translated into the Greek Bible. And that Greek Bible is called the Septuagint, right? The Septuagint, because tradition tells us it's in the Talmud, but it's also in the Letter of Aristeas, written 700 years probably before it was written down in the Talmud, that 70 or 72 Jewish scholars were brought, imported from Judea to Alexandria, to a little, you know, the Alexandrian lighthouse on that island of Pharos, right off of the port. They went there to Pharos, and they translate, over the course of a period of time, they translate the Hebrew Bible into the Septuagint. And the Letter of Aristeas is the oldest account of this translation. The translation happens in the 3rd century BC, and this is about 75 years later. And we open up the Letter of Aristeas with a plea. A representative of the Jewish community goes to Ptolemy, to the king of, remember that after Alexander dies, the empire is divided into three parts, right? So we have the Antiochids in the east, we have the Seleucids in the north, and then in Egypt we have the Ptolemies, right? And so Ptolemy to Philadelphus is the king in around 225 BCE, and one of the representatives of the Jews presents himself to Ptolemy and says, I know you're about to embark on this translation of the Hebrew Bible because you want it for your library, right? The Great Alexandrian Library. You're about to embark on this big project to translate the Hebrew Bible. This is all government-sponsored in the text. It's initiated by Ptolemy. We don't know if that's really the case. But Aristeas says to Ptolemy, before you do this, make a gesture of goodwill. Over the course of your many wars with the Syrians, with the Antiochids, you have taken Jewish captives, because these little kingdoms were all at war with each other. Actually, Judea was at stake. Sometimes Judea is under Ptolemaic rule, sometimes Judea is under Syrian Seleucid rule, and so Judea is like that little tiny sliver of territory that everyone's fighting over. And Aristeas says, you have Jewish captives, you need to release the captives before you start translating the Bible. And Aristeas gives a speech to the king, pleading with him to release these Jewish captives. And this text that you have in front of you is part of the speech. I'm not going to read the whole thing. This is tough Greek. But the argument that he makes is basically, do you ever read, I don't know what magazine this is, this is like in, it's not in People, but like Stars, They're Just Like Us. So this is like Jews, they're just like you. Because the argument is, the Jews that you have, that you're keeping in captivity, are really just like you. They're your people. They're not other. They're not foreigners. They're not barbarians that you have taken captive. Barbaros in Greek means foreigner. Because someone who doesn't speak Greek sounds like bar. So it just means foreigner. Then it has a negative connotation later. Barbarian obviously has a very negative connotation. But so Jews are not foreigners. They're not barbarians. They're good Greeks. And the argument, the foundation of this argument, is that the God that the Jews worship is a universal God. And in fact, that God is Zeus. This is a universal God who cares about everybody, equally, almost. Now, later on in the text, Aristeas makes a fascinating argument in defense of dietary law. So this is a Jew that actually keeps Shabbat dietary law and circumcised his sons. And there's a lot of very interesting material specifically about dietary law, why it's rational and legitimate, it makes a lot of sense. But we open up with this passage about the universality of the Jewish God. And so if you look at the underlined, this is what Aristeas says to the king. The Jews, these people, worship God, the overseer and the creator of all, whom all men worship. You don't need to know that Greek, sebontai, including ourselves, O king, except we have a different name. Their name for him is Zeus, right? We don't call him Zeus, but it's the same God. And now I'm going to pray to this God. And what's so interesting, if you go a few lines down, Aristeas prays to God, not on the assumption that God will save him because he's a Jew, but on the assumption God will save him because he's a person, right? So if you look, we offered our hearts in prayer to God to dispose his mind, 6 lines from the bottom, to the release of them all the Jewish captives, right? I had great hope, 3 lines from the bottom, as I presented the case for the saving of men, that God would execute the fulfillment of my requests, inasmuch as whatsoever men think to do in piety in the way of righteousness and attention to good works, God, the Lord of all, directs their acts and intentions. Over and over here, God is the Lord of humankind. Right? Then he homes in on specifics. Right? On Jewish, we have a lot of interesting material, like I said, defending ancestral law of the Jews. But the main argument right in this scene is that God is universal. This is a theme that we see over and over. Like God cares for every human being equally. And it is a response, an implicit response, to anti-Jewish claims that were circulating in the 2nd century BCE. What were Greeks saying about the Jews? What were people saying about the Jews at this time?
Something they're saying today.
Right?
I mean, with basically the
exactly.
Same thing they're saying today.
Yes. So what are they saying today?
They're separate.
They're insular. Right.
Superior.
They're particular. They're not good team players. Right?
And they're good with money.
That I haven't seen any ancient Greek literature, but, you know, wouldn't put it past them. Wouldn't put it past them. Yeah.
In those times, it was public worship. And if right. you were, you know, you couldn't right. take part in the worship of the Greeks or the Romans mm-hmm. or something. You know, you couldn't bow down to their god. You couldn't mm-hmm. eat their food. You couldn't everything.
Right.
So you weren't a good citizen.
Exactly. So, right. So there was no distinction between church and state, right? So if you didn't participate in the Festival of Dionysus, you were a bad patriot, right? You were not a good citizen. Okay, so I'm going to introduce you to a very similar text, but this is written about 150 years later by a philosopher that many observant Jews do not know of. This is Philo of Alexandria, who was born in around 20 BCE and dies in 50 CE. Because Philo's writings were preserved by the church, and because the rabbis do not cite Philo, Philo has not been incorporated into the tradition of what we call Jewish literature. But Philo is an observant Jew who writes in very, very difficult Greek. On the one hand, an observant Jew who, again, keeps Shabbat, dietary law, circumcision, reads the scriptures regularly, all the things that would have made you an observant Jew in the ancient world, but remember, we're pre-rabbinic, right? So he's not like, I don't know, I'm trying to think of something rabbinic. He's not, I don't know, kissing the mezuzah every time he walks into the Beis Medrash, but, or maybe he is, I don't know. But Philo is also very, very concerned with presenting Judaism as a religion of integrity to his intellectual, to his philosophical colleagues. And he has some very difficult passages here, and I'm not going to do all of these inside. The point that I want to make with Philo is that for Philo, and this is very Maimonidean, we see this in medieval 12th century philosophy, with Philo, God essentially is unknowable, right? Remember Rambam says you cannot say anything positive about God. You can only say God is not X, right? Because once you say God is X, then you're limiting God to a particular sphere, right? Implying some kind of limitation, some kind of corporeality, some kind of physicality. And then you get into the world of Avodah Zarah. So Rambam says you can't say anything positive about God. You can't know God. Philo actually says the same thing 1,200 years earlier. Philo says, God is so distant from humanity that you really can't make any claim about the divine. How does God enter into the world of the physical? How does God manifest divine activity or affect humanity if God is so distant and so outside the confines of time and space? Anybody know? There's a kind of a pipeline that God uses, according to Philo.
But how about all the miracles that we know that God did?
Right, and so there's... Yes, and the way that Philo explains his miracles is through a certain manifestation that Philo calls the Logos. Have you heard of the Logos?
Yeah.
Right, so the Logos means different things in Greek philosophy. The Stoics use it, but Philo uses it as the manifestation, the physical manifestation of the divine will. But God himself is outside the realm of time and space. And here we have a very difficult passage. Philo is very troubled by the idea in Bereishis Perek Bet, that God breathes life into Adam. Of course, there's a lot of allegorization, right? There's a lot of these kind of human actions on the part of God in Tanakh, and Philo explains that each and every one of them in his treatises, he has two particularly called... he has three treatises... Sorry? Right, how does God breathe? What does it mean, God's breathing? Is he doing CPR? Is he kind of laying there? No, of course. No, he's God. You can't do that, right? So, Philo, because this is one of the earliest moments where we see this extreme anthropomorphization of God in Tanakh, Philo explains something that we need to understand. Of course, this cannot be literal. What's happening here is that we're being given an explanation as to how God enabled humanity to have some kind of human conception of the divine. This is very tough, and we could spend hours just on this paragraph, so I'm not going to do that. Basically, there are three troubling things about here. First is the idea that God is breathing into something, right? He says there are three aspects here in the fifth line from the top. That which in-breathes, that's the God. That which receives, that which is in-breathed. Okay, that which in-breathes is God. What does that mean? That God is breathing life into the human. That which receives is the mind. That which is in-breathed is the spirit or breath. You can, by the way, kind of see why this would have appealed to Christian editors who preserved this, right? But Philo is not Christian. Even though medieval editors would write down the writings of Philo with the label Philo Christianus, he is Philo Judaicus. But anyway, go down to, and for what purpose? Five lines from the bottom. For what purpose save that we may obtain a conception of him? This whole passage, this whole idea of God breathing his spirit into humankind enables, it's an allegory for God enabling us to relate to God, to think about God. How could the soul have conceived of God had he not breathed into it and mightily laid hold of it? So God breathing to humankind enabled the soul to conceive of God. For the mind of man would never have ventured to soar so high as to grasp the nature of God, had not God himself drawn it up to himself so far as it was possible that the mind of man should be drawn up and stamped it with the impress of the powers that are within the scope of its understanding. This is incredibly hard. All the takeaway that we need today is to understand that for For Philo, God is unknowable. God is distant. We have some kind of trick that we do to ourselves. We think we know God. We talk about God's feelings, right? We talk about God's actions. And Philo says that's all an allegory. That's all a mask. It's very Platonic, actually. That's all kind of the shadow of reality. Because of our time limitations, I'm going to skip the next paragraph. I think I need to skip the next allegorical interpretation, paragraph 2. And the Testament of Joseph. I want to go to the rabbinic period. Although, by the way, you should know, the Testament of Joseph is from a collection of ancient texts called the Testaments of the 12 Patriarchs, 12 little stories, about what Jacob's sons, what Yaakov's sons said to their children on their deathbeds. It's a first century CE Greek text, also copied by later Christians, but definitely Jewish origins. And here in one of those little vignettes, in the speech of Yosef on his deathbed, he says, God is delighted by harmony among brothers, by the intention of a kind heart that takes pleasure in goodness. So we have this idea that God is unknowable, but we can say that God is totally good, right? Being on the one hand both distant from humanity and also being entirely infallible, of course, and yet interested in the good behavior of humankind. Now, when we get to the rabbinic period, we have a totally different picture. And I'm going to start with this early collection of Midrashim on Sefer Shemot, and that is the Michilta. This is a very poignant and comforting, I think, description of what happens to our relationship with God when we go into exile. And of course, this is like the ultimate question that Jews ask over the past 2,500 years. Why is God letting us suffer so much? Why is God allowing us to languish in exile? Where is our period of redemption that the prophets so powerfully promised? Where is it? Has God left us permanently? And look at what Rabbi Akiva teaches. Here, I'd ask for a reader if somebody wants to read. Totally different conception of God. Yes, please.
Rabbi Akiva says, were it not for scripture, it would be impossible to say it.
This is a common phrase that we see in Midrash. If it were not for scripture, it would be impossible to say it. What does that mean? I'm about to tell you something so radical that unless it was backed up verbatim in Tanakh, it would be almost heretical to say.
Right.
Okay, go on.
As it were, Israel said before the Holy One, Blessed be he, you have redeemed yourself. And so you find that wherever Israel went into exile, as it were, the divine presence went into exile with them.
Okay, so when Israel is in exile, God exiles himself. God is in exile. What could that possibly mean? That doesn't jive at all with what Hellenistic writers are writing about God, right? Only a couple centuries before, God is in exile. God has put himself in a timeout. Okay, keep going.
They went into exile to Egypt. The divine presence is together with them.
Sorry, this translation is not amazing. I'm sorry. Yeah, but it's okay. Yeah, so they go into exile in Egypt, and the divine presence, and then we have a proof text, right? Are you okay? I have some water. I have water. Do you want?
Oh.
Yeah, here.
Thank you.
Go. Sure.
Okay. Do you want me to go on?
No.
No.
Thank you. So we just have a list here of exiles, and then we have proof texts that indicate that God is in exile too. Shocking, right? But look what it says. It says, did I not reveal myself in Shmuel Aleph to the house of your father when they were in Egypt in bondage, right? It must be. God was in Egypt. Now, of course, I mean, God is everywhere. Like, you know, this is, I read something very interesting. Actually, Michael Fishbane, who's a professor at U of C, said, when you have this phrase, were it not for scripture, it'd be impossible to say it. Actually, almost always, it's not in scripture. Meaning, this passage in Shmuel Aleph isn't really saying that God exiled himself, right? So we're doing some somersaults over here, right? The reading of the Michilta is reading a pshat into Shmuel Aleph that might not be pshat, right? Because what is God saying? Is God saying, oh, I revealed myself to you in Egypt because I was only in Egypt and I thought I couldn't leave? Of course that's not what God is saying, right? But that's how the rabbis read it. Okay. Yes, and then we'll save other questions for the end. Yes.
Oh, all right.
You can.
Yes, the divine presence went into exile with him. What I think it also means is that there was no separation.
Right. We're going to get to that. Exactly. That's exactly right. That they're together. Yes. They go into exile to Babylon together, right? When the Israelites go to Babylon, to Babel, the Shekhinah is with them. And then we have another proof text, right? That Yeshayahu says, for your sake, I, says God, have been sent to Babylon, right? And Elam here would mean Persia, right? They go into exile with Persia. And then we have another proof text from Jeremiah, from Yirmiyahu. Now, Edom is, according to Rabbinic Midrash, is Rome, right? Roman, and right? Right, exactly. And in some later rabbinic midrash, when they say Edom, they mean Christianity. But here we would say this is the Roman exile, right? And then we have a reference to God coming from Edom, as if that's an allusion to the Roman exile. This is not pshat, right? But the Michilta is saying something very, very profound. I think goes back to what you just said. God doesn't abandon us in the exile. God is with us right there. And God is suffering, right? And this is like the famous line that we say about the Holocaust. Where was God? No! Where was humanity? Right? Yes.
Taken to the extreme, Torquemada is standing while people, Jews, are burning at the stake, and his figure is that he's crying for their soul. So this idea that God is in exile with while we are suffering, and its extreme brings that picture to mind.
100%. Yeah, nice. Right. So instead of thinking about is the break of our relationship with God permanent, the Michilta reframes the question. What break? There's no break in a relationship. God is here suffering with us. Right? Now we have a very, very interesting iteration of the intimacy between God and humanity, it's specifically God in the rabbinic community, in a very famous story that is known as the Oven of Acnai. Maybe some of you had heard of it. But it's a story that I go back to often because it tells us a lot about the mindset of the rabbinic community. It's preserved in Bava Metzia. This is a story that begins with a typical machloket between Rabbi Eliezer and Rabbi Yehoshua, who are arguing all the time. And Rabbi Eliezer, there are many, many debates between these two rabbis, and Rabbi Eliezer is often known as the Harif one, very strong, very opinionated. In this particular situation, there's a complicated question of whether you could purify a certain kind of an oven that is made of smaller parts, and Rabbi Eliezer says, I believe that he's on the side of saying that you can purify this kind of an oven. Nobody agrees with him. Anybody know the story? Besides, of course, our Mara Yavgard. Okay. Right. Okay. This is a very famous story. Right. Classic story. Okay. So, nobody agrees with Rabbi Eliezer. But Rabbi Eliezer has total confidence that he is right. He knows he's right. It's not even a question. To him, this is fact. This is an oven that can be declared clean. And the rabbis say it doesn't matter if you're right. Because we go by the majority rule. We go by the majority rule, and Rabbi Eliezer doesn't accept that. He rejects that. What does he say? He says, no. I have to be right. I am going to invoke God, and he's on my side. And I don't know if you've ever said this. I say this to my kids all the time. I have outnumbered you 5-4 because I have 5 votes. I have 4 kids. It doesn't matter how many. Okay. So the point is, God trumps all the rabbis. Right? If God says that this is an oven that can be declared clean, it doesn't matter how many rabbis disagree with that ruling. God is God. And in order to make this point, Rabbi Eliezer invokes miracles. This is very famous. I'm just going to, I think I'm going to read it myself for lack of time. Rabbi Eliezer, this is on line 6 from the top, brought forward every imaginable argument, but they did not accept them. And he said, if the halakha agrees with me, let this carob tree prove it. And suddenly, miraculously, the carob tree is torn 100 cubits out of its place. So the carob tree is like, whoa, I guess I gotta, prove that Rabbi Eliezer's right. And he just uproots, right? Goes 100 cubits. Later traditions say, no, 400 cubits. It was such a big miracle. The rabbis are unimpressed. No proof can be brought from a carob tree, they say. Doesn't matter that you were able to do a miracle We go by the majority rule. And Eliezer says, if the halacha agrees with me, I'll do an even bigger miracle. I'm going to make the current of water in that stream flow in the opposite direction. So he says, let the stream of water prove it. Whereupon the stream of water flows backwards. The rabbis, again, are unimpressed. They don't care. Do as many miracles as you want, Eliezer. We go by majority rule. And again, he says, okay, you know what? Maybe these natural, the trees and the rivers are not impressing you, but if the halakha agrees with me, let the walls of the Beit Midrash prove it. And the walls of the Beit Midrash get really stressed out. They start to fall, and Rabbi Yeshua says, hey, walls, when scholars are engaged, when chachamim are engaged in a halachic dispute, what have you to interfere? Stop crumbling. And so then the walls of the Beit Midrash are like, uh-oh, right? Hence, they did not fall in honor or maybe in fear of Rabbi Yeshua. They did not want to take a side, nor did they assume an upright position in honor of Rabbi Eliezer, and they're standing thus inclined to this day at a 45 degree angle, still really stressed out about what's going to happen. This is great, Agada. This is really amazing. And Eliezer, so determined to prove that his ruling is correct, he still doesn't give up. He says, if Alacha agrees with me, let it be proved from heaven. And God agrees with Eliezer, right? God says to the rabbis, what are you doing? Eliezer's right. You're the majority, fine, but who are you to dispute with the great Rabbi Eliezer? In all matters, the halakha agrees with him. Rabbi Yeshua says, you know what, God? Get out of town, okay? It is not in heaven. Lo b'shamayim hi. You do not need to be involved in this conversation. We're good, right? And now a later rabbinic layer says, what did Rabbi Yeshua mean by this, right? So we have the older story, and then we have the later commentary. What is Rabbi Yeshua saying to God? He says it's not in heaven. That's so disrespectful. Rabbi Yirmiyahu, a later Amora, has a suggestion. What is he saying? Once the Torah is given on Har Sinai, we don't pay attention to a heavenly voice. No bat kol, no divine intervention. God cannot just, you know, cause lightning and thunder and booming sounds from the heavens to change our halachic rulings. We have the authority to decide how halakha goes, even if we're wrong. That's incredibly radical, right? After the majority must one incline. And in a later story, Rabbi Natan, so we have these layers, these compositional layers of the Talmud. Later, Rabbi Natan met Eliyahu Hanavi on the street. As was his wont, Eliyahu would sometimes show up on the rabbinic streets and clarify questions for the rabbis. And Rabbi Natan says, Eliyahu, I never understood this story. What does this mean? How could we possibly understand that it was okay for Rabbi Yeshua to berate God for getting involved? And he says to Eliyahu, what did the Holy One, blessed be he, do in that hour? And Eliyahu answers, God laughed with joy. And what does God say? Last line. My sons have defeated me. My sons have defeated me. And in this story, we have the rabbis imbuing themselves with such incredible authority to take ownership over the Torah and mold it in a way that accommodates a diasporan reality, a reality in which there's still a lot of danger in terms of the continuity of the Jewish people. The rabbis create a halakhic system that is actually relatively lenient when you compare it with other systems that were circulating the Second Temple period, right? The rabbis are not Sadducees, they're not Essenes, those are much more stringent ways of living, right? And the rabbis do this by imbuing themselves with a degree of authority. But it's also rather shocking, right? How could it be that we depict God in this way? In a way that God can be defeated and that he's allowing this to happen, right? And not only that, but God suffers, right? God is intimately involved in the affairs of humankind. It seems so very different than what we have in the Second Temple period. Okay, sure.
Can you clarify, you said the rabbis were not stukim? So the stukim, how would they have ruled?
So we have these three sects, and maybe a fourth. We have the Sadducees, the Sadukim, the Prushim, the Pharisees, who are kind of the proto-rabbis, and we have the Essenes, who are very different, kind of a small minority of these sectarian worlds. And so the Sadducees, first of all, reject oral law completely. And because they read the Torah and the law in the Torah literally, it's a much more extreme form, right? Because there are certain things in the Torah that the rabbis actively read metaphorically, right? An eye for an eye was never in rabbinic tradition, an eye for an eye, ever. It was always monetary. right? And there are certain issues in terms of capital punishment in the Torah that the rabbis say, no, this is not, we're going to do everything we can to not find someone guilty of murder because we are not going to enact this. You know, there's this famous statement in the Gemara that a court that put to death more than 170 years is a cruel court, right? So the Sadducees were known to be more stringent. We know very little about the Sadducees from their own mouths because we don't have texts written by them. So we only have texts written by their opponents, so it's hard to know exactly what was going on in that community, but it does seem like they were more extreme. Yeah, and certainly the Essenes were too. Okay. So now we have this strange, kind of shocking transition, right? And I think, like I said at the beginning of the talk, it is parallel with what happens to Moshe, but it's the inverse of what happens to the Torah. In the rabbinic period, the Torah becomes increasingly universalized. As God becomes more intimately involved in human affairs, more particular, right? More, I don't want to say humanized, but the way that God is depicted is very, very, very personal. The Torah becomes increasingly universal. And I want to show you just a few sources in which this happens, and then we'll talk about what this all means. Back to the Mechilta. The same Mechilta that has God suffering in exile has the Torah being a universal gift for all of humankind. How could this be? Very confusing, right? This is an incredible little passage in the Mechilta. I'm going to read it because we have 9 minutes. So on this verse in Shemot Yotet, right before the moment of Har Sinai, the Jews encamp in the wilderness. Why the wilderness? They're about to go into the land of Israel, right? It's before the people sins, before the Chet HaEgel. They're about to go into the land of Israel. It's like a month away, right? They're going to go into the land of Israel. So why does the Torah have to be given in a desert? What a bummer. There's nothing in the desert. The Torah has to be given in a free place. In a demos, you know the word from the Gemara, Farhesia, in public? It's a Greek word. It means an open public place. Had the Torah been given in the land of Israel, the Israelites, the Jews, would have said to the foreign nations, you have no share in our Torah. So as a preventative measure against the Jews saying to non-Jews, you have no involvement in our Torah, the Torah is given in the wilderness. Look at the third line. Now that it was given in the wilderness publicly and openly, in a place that is free for all, everyone wishing to accept it could come and accept it. So this is not a way actively to allow the foreign, I'm trying to think about how to say this. It's not a vehicle meant for all the foreigners to be a part of at that moment, but it's a preventive measure against the Jews because it's a message being sent directly to the Israelites, right? No one else is there, right? You're in the middle of nowhere. There are no foreign nations at the revelation. It's only the Israelites. This is a message to the Israelites saying, don't be insular, right? Don't be particularist. Don't say, this is our Torah, you can't have a share in it. Because a daf God specifically is given the wilderness to signify that all people can take part in it. Now, why does this Hebrew text, the Mechilta, have a Greek word in it? Two Greek words. There are Hebrew words it could have used. Why does it say Farhesia? Why the Greek word? I think that this is a signal, right? We're going to use a Greek word that signifies to Greek-speaking peoples. Remember, this is 2nd century, 3rd century CE. Greek is the universal language. It's the English of the ancient world, right? This is a key. This is a door opening into the world of the rabbis. Here's this Greek term. You could enter into the world of the Torah even if you don't speak Hebrew. This is, again, very radical. But on the other end, right? In rabbinic text, we have God being so humanized and we have the Torah being for everybody. Strange and almost counterintuitive, right? I'm not sure. I have my own kind of source sheet that's a little more elaborate, so I'm not sure what other sources you have. You have Mishnah Avot, right?
Right.
Trying to think what else we can do here. Oh, thank you. You could look at, these are actually not hard to read. You could look at these on your own. I mean, but there's this very, very famous statement in the very opening of Pirkei Avot on three things the world stands, on Torah, on Avodah, right? Avodah, of course, was a term that meant temple service and then ultimately means prayer in rabbinic parlance, right? And pursuing peace. What can we say about this with our remaining 6 minutes? What can we say about this transition, about God becoming increasingly personal in the rabbinic period and the Torah becoming increasingly universal? Any thoughts?
It's got to have to do with Christianity. I mean, because you have this Greek God who's so far away, a philosopher, Aristotelian, whatever, and then Christianity comes based on this. Well, we can't, God the Father is just too far away, so in order to deal with the world, there has to be God the Son. You know, as a savior taking on a personal body and all this kind of stuff. So they're trying to combat that. They're trying to say, and then even putting in the Greek words, they're competing against another religion, and they're trying to say that you can have this kind of universality.
I don't know. So I sometimes hesitate to jump on the Christianity train.
Okay.
I don't know if that's not true. I think they could have had a sensitivity towards what was going on with the rise of Christianity, although it doesn't become this full-blown legal religion until the 4th century. I think that what you're saying could very well be true. I think we could also contextualize it even more, because remember, in the 1st and 2nd century, as we begin kind of this early rabbinic period, Christianity is not a thing yet.
But you've got Jews who are Christians.
Correct. Right. Right. And so it could very well be that you see this kind of parallel tendencies that you could trace, right? And as the Christian God becomes kind of this physical son, right? So I think that it could be part of it. I also think that we could add to that. I think that somebody, I think you want to raise
one? I was going
to
just say something similar. Oh, okay. If you look at timelines.
Right. So of course, right, because in the Greek world, when you're reading Homer, right, you're reading the Iliad, right, or you're reading all these great epics, you're reading about heroes that have no fault. That's not necessarily the case in later literature. Yeah, please.
I was going to say, the Greeks are known, go to Aristotle. Aristotle thinks that perfect means unchanging, eternal, unchanging, stable. Judaism doesn't believe that. We believe that God is active and drawn into here as opposed to unchanging. It's a completely different worldview from the Greeks.
Yeah, but I would just nuance that a little bit, because in the Second Temple period, these were observant Jews, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and they were God-fearers, and you know they kept Shabbat and they kept dietary law, right?
But in the rabbinic period, they were answering these claims that.
Yeah, I think that I think that that is definitely a big part of it. Yeah, yeah. Please.
I think that it's kind of the closer we were with God, it was okay to keep him kind of separate. But now that God was kind of separating from us,
we
need to bring him more inside.
Yeah, I would definitely agree with that, and I would say it like this. Look, after 70 CE, and especially after Bar Kokhba in 135, there's a huge question of whether, now I guess I will say the Christians, is the Christian claim correct that God has abandoned the Jews? Where is God? Our suffering has become so extreme by depicting God as experiencing the experiences of Israel, and sometimes even as submitting to the authority of the rabbis, you have a God who is not all powerful and all distant, but a God who deeply, deeply identifies with the suffering of the Jewish people and also gives it meaning, right?
He hasn't abandoned us.
Correct. Right. And by universalizing the Torah, the rabbis present their Judaism as transcendent, right? So you need both, right? Because if you only have God as being this very personalized God, then you will legitimize those claims against the Jews. I know I'm speaking fast and now it's getting complicated, that the Jews are misanthropic, the Jews are insular. And so the rabbis do have their cake and eat it too with this model.
God is not just a prime mover.
Exactly, right. Yeah. So on the one hand, we have this transcendent teaching from God that transcends time and space. That's the Torah. But God himself is deeply involved in the affairs of humankind, specifically with the affairs of Israel. And that gives meaning to the suffering of the Jewish people in a way that's profoundly comforting. So I think we have one more comment.
It doesn't have to be an either or.
Right.
that they can hold both at the same time.
Exactly.
In order for, and we do this all the time.
Exactly.
There's always like we have to have it either one way or another, and that's not human. That's not how humans are.
Right.
So they, even if they seem somewhat contradictory, it's the nature of that existence at that time that we preserve to this day.
Precisely. Yeah. Thank you. Thank you. And with that, I will close with Marianne's words of wisdom. Thank you very, very much for coming. I hope you have a great day of learning. And I'm here for a few minutes if you have any questions.
Rambam.
Oh, sure.
Thank you.
Sure.
So Rashi, you know, France was the center of Rashi. And now, probably a significant portion of Torah literature is in English.
Right.
But also, when you talk about the Torah to other people, in Gezel Kabracha, it says, Hashem Sinai, Zaran, Elfia, Mikaran. So even though we have, you know, that Medrash, Hashem went around to the other nations, he didn't close it to them, because next is in 2 weeks in the Torah, we have an Aruah, Lot, it's our Torah, because partly because we chose it and we're chosen, but it's not exclusive.
100%. That Sifrei, that Midrashim Sifrei, I have in the longer version of this talk on the source sheet.
The one about
the God going to all the nations.
Yeah, because it's funny how kids come home from school and they say, Hashem came around and said, oh, do you want to go? Oh, it's because we can't kill. We don't